Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books and East European Studies podcast series. I am your host, Amanda Swain. Today, we'll be talking with Mary Neuberger about her recent book, Balkan Smoke, published by Cornell University Press. Mary Neuberger is professor of history and director of the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Texas, Austin. The introduction to Balkan Smoke begins, "There is something about tobacco that drew me in," and this history of the role of tobacco and smoking in the making of modern Bulgaria did the same for me. I'm looking forward to hearing more about the book today. So welcome back to New Books in East European Studies, Mary Neuberger.
Hello.
Hello. So Mary, as a more detailed introduction, I wonder if you would tell us a bit about yourself and how you became interested in Balkan history.
Okay, well, I started, I guess, my educational career doing Russia. I studied Russian in high school. I studied Russian in undergrad, which I got a Russian studies degree, ultimately, the University of Oregon. And then I went to graduate school at the University of Washington and was doing kind of a geography master's, actually, which turned out to be rather interdisciplinary. And I have to give the credit to James Felak, he'll be happy to hear this, for his Balkan history class that he taught while I was in graduate school, very much, I think, inspired by his advisors, who were the Yelovitches, the famous Barbara and Charles Yelovich from Indiana. And he taught a Balkan history class that was just so fun and inspiring. He's a great lecturer. And I was drawn in by the Balkans, not just because of how animated his class was, but because it brought together a lot of my intellectual interests. So I was interested in the Slavic world, but I was also interested in the periphery of that world, in the areas where the Slavic Christian populations lived in direct contact and interacted with Muslim populations, Turkic Muslim populations, and other kinds of Muslim populations. And so the Balkans, for me, encapsulated those interests, brought together those interests, and I got an opportunity to study Bulgarian on a FLAS fellowship in the summer of 1993, and then to go to Bulgaria in the summer of 1994. And let's just say I was hooked at that point. And I remember James Felak saying to me at one point, "Are there people who know you from before you were interested in the Balkans?" Because it was such a transformation that he saw. I was suddenly obsessed with this region. I think traveling there, I was just fascinated by the kind of mosaic of culture. I loved studying the Bulgarian language, but also hearing the other related South Slavic languages. But also, it's just an incredibly beautiful region. It's all mountains and seas, warm water, beaches. The food was great. I have to say the food had a lot to do with me deciding to do the Balkans. I really was captivated by the food. Long story short, that's what I pursued for my dissertation. And because the war was going on in the former Yugoslavia while I was in graduate school, I had to steer away from that part of the world. And Bulgaria ended up being the kind of obvious choice for a number of reasons. And so I've been studying Bulgaria ever since.
Well, great. Having been in the master's program at the same time you were, although in a different program, I too can speak to James Felak's ability as a teacher to inspire students. So going from an interest in Bulgaria to specifically an interest in tobacco and smoking, what brought you to that as a topic?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like maybe a random kind of transition, but for me, it actually makes a lot of sense in that my first book was on Muslim minorities in Bulgaria, which, you know, sounds like it obviously it comes directly out of those interests that I developed in graduate school in, ethnic conflict and coexistence, in, as I mentioned, kind of nationalism identity in the Balkans. And while I was studying those populations in Bulgaria, which live in compact enclaves in southern Bulgaria, also in areas of northeastern Bulgaria, but traveling around in the Muslim parts populated areas of southern Bulgaria in the Rhodope Mountains, I saw tobacco hanging, drying from the eaves of houses, under these kind of drying tents, you know, these different kind of places. And I was I had never really seen tobacco, having grown up in the Northwest, where we don't grow tobacco. But even if I had grown up in parts of the United States where they grow tobacco, it's done quite differently in the Balkans. It grows up in the mountains, not down in plantations. It's hand-dried on these long strings that they kind of hand-sew the leaves onto. So when I saw it, I was, what is that? And someone said, tobacco. And so I was intrigued by this idea of the fact that tobacco was grown in Bulgaria in a very different way than in the United States, but also that it was grown primarily in these regions where there were Muslim populations. And so these populations that did not urbanize, much like the Bulgarian populations had in the socialist period, remained living in these little mountain villages and in these communities where one of the few crops at that time that you, and even today in a certain sense, that you could really grow was tobacco. And so the tobacco economy made a lot of sense for that region. And so that's where my interest originally started. And I started reading more about it, and it grew much broader than the Muslim element, which is part of my book, but actually not, you know, that it's only sort of like a theme throughout certain chapters, but the larger book is much more about the Bulgarians and the smoking economy and the geopolitics of tobacco and all other kinds of issues.
And you do cover a lot in from the Ottoman Empire all the way up through communist Bulgaria, and that's a long history. So if we start at the beginning with the Ottoman Empire, can you tell us about how coffee houses were associated with smoking and how they served as sites of a nascent Bulgarian national identity?
So this is one of the arguments I make in my very first chapter, which is about the coffee house. And one of the things, the larger sort of frame of my book was I was interested in writing a cultural history of tobacco as a commodity that looked both at production and exchange, but also consumption. And so that was one of the, I think, more interesting issues to get at in terms of sources, like how do you study smoking? Where do you look for sources on smoking? And so what I came across was one of the sort of focuses of talking about consumption was smoking, what I call smoking venues. So the coffee house, also in later periods, the tavern, the bar. And what interested me about tobacco was that it crossed the line between the kind of sober cafe on the one hand, or coffee house, and the drunken bar. That it was something that one could do both at work or in kind of productive settings, or one could do while intoxicated, you know, and during leisure, in kind of leisure venues. And so the coffee house, though, was interesting because it's an institution. If one wants to think of it as an institution or a context about which there's been a lot written. And so I looked at the kind of global literature on the coffee house. And one of the things that came out of that was that the coffee house was an essentially Near Eastern institution. In other words, it came out of the Ottoman lands. These are where the first coffee houses were. This is where coffee originated, even as a product and a crop. And that the coffee house was something that fascinated visitors from Europe and other parts of the world that came to the Ottoman Empire, and they reproduced the coffee house in their own context. And so then much came to be written about the coffee house in other contexts, in England, in Germany, in Italy, in Vienna, etc. But it was something that had been appropriated from the Ottoman Empire and then changed in these different contexts. So Bulgaria, being part of the Ottoman Empire, had a history of the coffee house being an essential part of the fabric of, you know, essentially Bulgarian life in a sense. But what I realized was that the coffee house was actually a Muslim institution. In other words, Christians didn't go to the coffee house until the 19th century. And so this was something really interesting to me, that Christians actually went to taverns and consumed, in Bulgaria, mostly wine and rakia, just kind of brandy, whereas the Muslim populations in whatever village or town went to the coffee house, where they drank coffee and smoked tobacco since about the 16th and 17th centuries, when tobacco was brought from the New World. And so it's, long story short, I argue that when Bulgarians began to enter the coffee house in the 19th century, far from being just a leisure venue, the coffee house is where people conducted commerce, where people carried out administration of villages and neighborhoods, where all kinds of productive activity was happening. And when Bulgarians began to engage in those activities in the coffee house, is precisely this period, 19th century, when they kind of came of age, when they discovered themselves as a nation, when they began to have a separate national identity, when they began to organize a national movement. And so I don't think it's just an accident. I mean, I hate to kind of create some sort of direct causation, but this was the moment when they began to this kind of these venues of male sociability and discussion, exchange of information, and this sort of sober environment of exchange was where one can trace in a lot of ways some of the beginnings of the national movement.
I like that you said that Bulgarians learn how to be Bulgarian and to smoke at the same time. So in addition to this sociability in the coffee houses and this learning to be Bulgarian and this development of a national identity, you also address the contribution of tobacco production to, or at least the alignments of tobacco production to political and social violence at the end of the 19th century, particularly in Macedonia and Thrace. Can you tell us more about that?
So the early 20th century, one thing I just discovered and was intrigued about was the early 20th century was a time of incredible violence for Ottoman Macedonia and Thrace. There were all kinds of, I mean, part of the issue was there were competing claims to that territory. And so you had brigands and you had organized bands, for example, the IMRO or the Internal Macedonian Revolutionary Organization, running around Macedonia, committing various acts of terrorist violence, I guess you could say, kidnapping people, setting off bombs. There was a lot of assassinations. These kinds of things were going on. So it was an incredibly violent period. But what I found interesting was that this period of increased violence coincides exactly with the period in which tobacco becomes commodified, in which it becomes incredibly valuable, and in which you have more international players coming into the region, beginning to buy tobacco at really high prices. One of those players was the American Tobacco Company. And so we're suddenly they're offering 2-3 times the price for tobacco. So it moves from being a subsistence plant where people were mostly producing it for their own consumption. Some of it was being exported or, well, within the Ottoman Empire, trade to Istanbul, to, you know, Egypt and other contexts, but most of it was small scale production. And so you have this increase of production, a massive increase of smuggling for a number of reasons, coinciding with this increased violence. And so I looked into that and I found out that IMRO was involved in the tobacco economy in a lot of ways. And basically, the tobacco economy in many ways was funding many of their activities. They were taxing people directly. I mean, this is obviously a non-government entity running around taxing people who were growing tobacco, and also getting large amounts of money, kind of payoff hush money from larger tobacco merchants. And so it was funding in many ways their activity. But I would also argue just the availability of that kind of a cash crop that's easy to move, that's it's in a sense it's like drug trafficking, because it was so heavily taxed that by smuggling it, you know, you had a highly profitable venture, that it kind of, in a sense, contributed to this increased violence. But I think also because it created more haves and have-nots, certain populations benefited from the trade greatly, others didn't, that it also set the scene for other kinds of violence that exploded rural populations versus urban populations, for example. You could see the violence erupting along these social lines around that time as well. And so I use that chapter to kind of explore those kinds of possibilities.
And you also emphasize the importance of wars, not just this violence that was happening in within the Balkan region, but the Balkan Wars and World War I in particular, and the development of tobacco production in Bulgaria. Can you talk more about that?
So this was not just a Bulgarian phenomenon. It was a global phenomenon, but both of the world wars, the Balkan Wars to a certain extent as well, but certainly the world wars were times in which there was a huge spike in global consumption of tobacco, both during the wars and after. And during the wars, it had a lot to do with the provisioning of troops at the front. There was this, you know, these were massive wars of mobilization, and there was this perceived need to provide cigarettes to the troops, and there was a massive movement to do that. And so in doing that, of course, you're needing to produce more tobacco. But then after each war, you have a new kind of generation of smokers returning from the front. And so there's this spike in consumption. At the same time, women in both wars on the home front are entering the workplace, are taking on new kinds of roles. And as emancipated women in that period, smoking was very much part of the package of, you know, becoming kind of urban professional or working class women in different contexts. And so smoking became part of these kind of the transformation of those two wars. But also it was prevalent in media at the time. Of course, everyone's, you know, watching more and more American films, for example, where you had the glamorous smoking woman or man featured. And so even in terms of media, it was something that was, stimulating tobacco consumption. But part of it was also technologies. The cigarette technology, which by then you had cigarette rolling machines, for example. And so cigarettes became very cheap, easy to get a hold of. And unlike in the past, where smoking was much more of a ritual that took time, that you had to sit down and fill the pipe of whatever kind, and you couldn't really be on, you know, walking down the street, for example. With cigarettes, people were smoking at a whole new volume, and you could smoke, you know, here, there, everywhere, walking down the street, et cetera. And so it became the technology of tobacco itself also changed the sort of volume of consumption. So globally, you see this enormous increase of tobacco production and consumption. In Bulgaria, they had a very particular role in both world wars, and that was supplying, in the First World War, the Central Powers, so Central Europe, essentially. And in the Second World War, Nazi Germany and their allies, New Europe. And so they, through this need to provision, you know, not just their own troops, but the Germans, the involved in these wars and that were allied with Bulgaria, they stepped up production and also because they occupied Macedonia and Thrace, they had a much larger area in which to do this. They stepped up production as part of their new wartime alliance kind of arrangement. And then after both of those wars, they had new clients. Well, after the First World War, they had Central Europe definitely as a client for Bulgarian tobacco. Second World War is a little bit different because they enter the communist bloc and now they have to kind of stop supplying Germany and Austria. And suddenly Russia becomes their new external market.
And in the interwar period, you talk again about the role of coffee houses as an important intellectual, political, and social centers in Bulgaria. But what I found most striking was the development of an abstinence movement that brought together Protestants and communists.
Yeah, abstinence is something I'm doing more work on now. So it's something I'm fascinated with. This idea or this impulse that people should not consume a certain thing. We usually associate abstinence movements with alcohol. Abstinence movements originally began as anti-alcohol campaigns, but in the earlier, kind of mid-19th century, gaining momentum in the late 19th century, but tobacco was added to the abstinence kind of portfolio, along with gambling and prostitution and a lot of other things by late in the 19th century, because it became so closely associated with drinking. And so anti-smoking and anti-drinking campaigns in Bulgaria originated with American Protestant missionaries for the most part, although there's some, you can find some strands of kind of indigenous, I guess you could say, or local abstinence movements. So they can be a Protestants, but also socialism. So, and some of these early Bulgarian socialists who were interested in abstinence actually were educated by American Protestants and in American Protestant schools, but others were not. For example, a lot of Bulgarians were studying across Europe, but in particular in Switzerland, where again, there was a Protestant element, but also a heavily socialist element that looked to abstinence as part of this creating of a new man or this kind of socialist vision of progress. And so by the interwar period, you had two coherent abstinence movements in Bulgaria, one coming out of the Protestants and tightly connected to local American Protestants and Bulgarian Protestant converts, and the other, an atheistic socialist, or in this case, communist of all the stripes of socialists, the group that would become the Bulgarian Communist Party, were the most tied to abstinence. Not all Bulgarian communists were, though. It was kind of an element within that movement that became organized under the abstinence banner. And so these two abstinence movements actually were together in a larger union and kind of worked uneasily together throughout the period. But since the communists were under scrutiny by the interwar government, the Protestants often tried to hold them at arm's length because they didn't want to be seen as associated with communists. From the communist side, they were actually using the abstinence movement, as a front for their activities. They had, since they couldn't openly operate as the Communist Party for most of that period, they had to work through other kinds of organizations. And so this became a front for many of their activities in that period. So they would gather to talk about abstinence, but they could also talk about other issues related to their movement and goals.
And you've already mentioned about Bulgaria's alliance with Nazi Germany in World War II. And can you talk more about that relationship developing in the 30s and the consequences of that alliance for Bulgaria and the role of tobacco production in that?
In looking at the interwar period, you can see this increase of tobacco production throughout that period and this increase in export. And most of that export is going to Central Europe, mostly to Germany, but also Austria, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, for example. They're still exporting some to the United States and the UK, for example, and nearby, you know, Egypt and places. But Germany becomes their largest customer, in essence. And this is for raw tobacco, not for cigarettes, which they're not exporting in this period. And I think this has a lot to do with the fact that because of their World War I alliance, Germany had developed a taste for this particular kind of tobacco that grew in Bulgaria. And so Germany becomes this viable trade partner for Bulgaria. And I mean, for people who know this period, they know that in the course of the interwar period, of course, there's the economic crisis of, you know, the world depression, which causes in many ways across Europe this move to the right, where you have fascist and other kind of rightist governments taking over. But also fascism became a really viable model. The Italian and German model became an attractive model for most of Eastern Europe that went that direction politically, but also had close alliances with Germany and Italy in this period. And it wasn't just because they seemed like this attractive model, working model for running a country in a time of chaos and economic despair, but also because Germany traded with these countries actively in a way that, you know, the Western allies were not. And so by late in the period, by the 1930s, Bulgaria was doing something like 80% of its trade with Germany. And so it really, in many ways, was just not an option to turn away from Germany and look for a Western alliance. Now, there were plenty of people in Bulgaria who wanted to do that. There were diplomats at the highest level. There were all kinds of people interested in aligning themselves, for example, with the UK and France. But it just wasn't a viable option because of this relationship. So 80% of their trade going to Germany, a large part of that was tobacco. And so in many ways, this was the deal with the devil. I mean, tobacco was keeping them afloat economically, but it also meant that this reliance, this dependence on Germany. And so they entered the war on the German side, which of course was the losing side, and they lost, in some ways, they think of it as a big loss of territory. They lost primarily the territories they occupied during World War II, plus a little bit more territory that they had gained as a result of World War I and the Balkan War. So Bulgaria, you know, it was a fateful decision in a sense. And tobacco, I argue, had a lot to do with it.
Mm-hmm. And so after the war, as you mentioned, Bulgaria was part of the communist bloc, and you spend quite a bit of time talking about tobacco and both tobacco production and smoking in communist Bulgaria. And I was fascinated by these contradictory stances towards tobacco and smoking on the part of the communist authorities. Can you talk more about what you call the deep inconsistencies and problems of socialist leisure theory and practice as revealed in those attitudes? And how was tobacco production and smoking changing during that time?
Sure. So when I was studying tobacco under communism, I kind of looked at two different sets of sources, at least. I mean, I was looking at documents from all different kinds of places, but I spent a lot of time looking at the industry, the tobacco industry, which was organized under the monopoly called Bulgar Tabak, their sources. So the documents from the company, the trade journal, Bulgarsky Tutun, but also the memoir of the head of the tobacco concern for most of the period, Dmitry Yadkov. And so in these sources, it revealed that the tobacco industry was central to the Bulgarian economy, in many ways fueling it, because it was constantly growing in terms of what they were producing, in terms of the technologies they were using. They were really at the cutting edge. No other industry had that much, those kind of resources at their disposal to actually develop and use different technologies to trade with the West openly, and appropriate Western technologies, etc. And so they really became critical to the Bulgarian economy. And really, from the point of view of the industry, the more that people consumed, the more tobacco that they sold, cigarettes that they sold, because it was more actually cigarettes in this period, both within Bulgaria and to other countries of the bloc, that this was indicative of socialist achievement. And so consumption had to continue rising. They had to continue providing the consumers with what they wanted. And in this, in their minds, this was building socialism, was made possible through this increased consumption, through this increased production, the selling of tobacco. On the other hand, you had sources mainly from health, kind of within the Bulgarian public health sector, that began to be concerned about studies coming out primarily from the West, because they weren't conducting their own, on the long-term, you know, health effects of tobacco, cancer being one of them, but of course there's many other things, but also a lot of other things like wasting of time for smoking tobacco, the effects on women and reproduction and tobacco, and all other kinds of social costs. And so they began to write increasingly, and this really started in the mid-60s, but gained momentum in the 70s and 80s, anti-tobacco, anti-smoking literature. They put out posters, pamphlets, they organized talks. They had all kinds of, this whole anti-smoking rhetoric began, but really not in an open conversation with the industry, unlike in the United States, where you have a much more open confrontation happening between grassroots anti-tobacco lobbies, who then use the legal system to kind of bring down tobacco in a certain way, to eliminate, you know, eliminate advertising, to rein in a lot of their practices, et cetera. Here, because it was a government, you know, Bulgarian tobacco was literally, you know, the backbone of the Bulgarian economy, you couldn't really openly confront it or take it down or even have them adjust any of their practices in any meaningful way in the whole period. So Instead, you have this anti-smoking kind of lobby in literature, which I believe was rather half-hearted, actually. And I believe most people didn't really listen to or take to heart. And I think for many, especially in the period that it happened, late communism, there was a lot of cynicism, it was seen as propaganda coming from the state that people weren't really interested in hearing. In a period in which there were all kinds of shortages and problems in the system, people were not going to give up their cigarettes, which was the one thing that you could get cheaply that was available. And so this became part of people's lives, you know, part of their leisure kind of activities, which the Bulgarian state provided and promoted. And so nobody was going to, you know, willfully kind of give up smoking. And so you see the numbers go up, up, up through the whole period and no real public response to studies coming out of the West. In fact, Bulgarian tobacco was saying, oh, no, no, they're wrong. That only applies to American tobacco, not to Bulgarian tobacco. And so they kind of try to sweep it under the rug, even though health officials were saying, no, no, these are real studies and this is really the case. What they were saying was more or less falling on deaf ears. And I think in the post-communist period, you know, a lot has happened, but I think this idea of anti-smoking campaigns as being propaganda coming from an unwelcome source, you know, it's still kind of the case. It's a message people don't want to hear. People don't want their lives controlled. And in fact, I think for some people, and I've heard this before, they said, even the communists didn't take away our smoking. Even the communists let us smoke. Authoritarian regime, let us smoke in the cafes, you know, let us smoke in public places. And now this new, you know, regime and under the influence of the EU is trying to tell us what to do and trying to control our lives in a whole new way. So I think that legacy, you know, actually is having an effect. But I think there's lots of other things that are changing the way people think about smoking. The new modern is to not smoke, whereas the the modern that people learned in the 20th century was that smoking was the way to be kind of modern and fashionable.
Mm-hmm. And you also talk about Bulgar Tabak's role in relations between the communist bloc and the West during the Cold War, and particularly their engagement with American tobacco companies. Can you tell us a little more about that?
This was one of the most fun parts of the project. It was really exciting to explore this because I did a little work on just kind of looking at how East-West trade was opening up in this period, actually initially under the LBJ administration. And it was American tobacco that was at the forefront of wanting trade with the Eastern Bloc to proceed. They really wanted to enter that market in whatever way possible. So American tobacco companies were pretty aggressive about kind of muscling their way into the Bloc. And Bulgaria was seen as besides Yugoslavia, which was, of course, outside the Bloc and had tobacco, but not on the scale, didn't raise it on the scale that Bulgaria did. And didn't have control of the kind of market Bulgaria did, which was the Soviet market, which was, you know, the largest market in the world. Global tobacco was very interested in Bulgaria and in what Bulgaria was doing in their tobacco industry and in the markets that they had access to. And so I explored this kind of long drawn out period of meetings and negotiations and how Bulgar Tabak was able to meet with and use Philip Morris and R.J. Reynolds and these other American tobacco companies to their own ends. I mean, they were able to import all kinds of technologies at very little cost to themselves in many ways and really develop their industry. They really needed those American technologies in the 70s and 80s, and they used them to their own advantage. But I think at the same time, the American tobacco companies also got what they wanted, and that is that their name and their brand made it into Eastern Europe via Bulgaria, not just Bulgaria, but Poland and the Soviet Union, I know, also set up Marlboro factories, for example, that were producing Marlboro cigarettes with local tobaccos and local labor in local factories and then distributing them locally. And so this was the only way they were going to get into that market. was through using local, you know, actors and parties and factories. They could not import directly except for in very small amounts that went into hard currency stores, for example. And so I think that there was also something in it for those companies, and that is that they got into the Eastern Bloc with their brands. In that period, they made some money off of licensing agreements and things as well. But so in many ways, it was a mutually beneficial, you know, relationship at the time. But it also is an interesting case of this kind of East-West engagement through trade that I found really fascinating in that period.
Mm-hmm. So what is Bulgar Tabak doing now in post-communist Bulgaria? What's its status?
Well, now it's no longer a government monopoly. I mean, it's had this kind of long, painful privatization process. Well, actually, okay, back up. So the privatization process they've been attempting to privatize it for a long time. And so I think it still technically is a government monopoly, but it doesn't have the same kind of, I guess you could say, market share. It's what they say now. Within Bulgaria, and it definitely doesn't export. It doesn't have the kind of export role it had before. It's become a very small tobacco concern that has gone through a lot in terms of politics and a lot of kind of internal struggles over what its future is going to be. So it still exists. It produces new kinds of cigarettes for the local market. For example, there's a brand called Marilyn that has a picture of Marilyn Monroe on it. But locals do buy it. It has something like, I think, to 30% of the Bulgarian market share, so which is respectable. But beyond Bulgaria, they don't really, you know, sell it. And so for the Bulgar Tabak people, they really see the communist period as their glory days, in which the bloc allowed them this really kind of captive market, and where they were able to really employ all the resources of the government and, you know, kind of work through the system. And they had a special place, of course, with Western companies who had to woo them in order to access those markets, that kind of thing. And now they have to compete with these Western companies that have slick advertisements, which they can put up in Bulgaria, unlike, you know, they can't put up in the United States, these advertisements, for example. They can put them up there. And so it's hard for them to compete with these and they attempted. But, you know, locally they've done some competition, but globally, no. So, yeah, so it's kind of a shadow of its former self at this point.
This is a really far-reaching study, and both the time period of going from the Ottoman Empire to the end of the communist period, and then also looking at both production and consumption, tobacco and smoking. So when you think about this project, what for you stands out as the most important thing that you learned or that you feel this contributed to thinking about the making of modern Bulgaria?
Well, I think often historians, you know, we look at history and there are things, you know, I think that are sort of hidden in history that we don't always look at. And I think sometimes if we take something like, in this case, you know, a commodity that has a major transformative effect on a country and its place in the world, on its local social relations, on, you know, so many different aspects of Bulgarian history, if we take something like that and suddenly we rethink the history of Bulgaria, as I did, through the lens of this commodity, then we begin to rethink a lot of questions of Bulgarian history and realize that there are these other factors, that these other kinds of things that transform society that we don't always, you know, look at, that we don't always focus on. And so I think, like, taking that tobacco thread through this whole period, for me, I guess, makes me kind of reconsider how much our lives are affected by something like what we consume on a daily basis, or, you know, that these things are also driving history as much or more than, you know, who's in power, who's sitting in the palace or the White House. But, you know, what we're actually consuming on a daily basis is also driving history in important ways.
Great. Well, I encourage our listeners to read the book because it's, I found it really quite fascinating. And thank you, Mary, for giving us so much of your time. And I'd like to know what you're working on next.
Well, I have several projects going at the same time, so it's kind of hard to say, but right now I'm working on, I'm co-editing a book on actually food in Russia and Eastern Europe, which is a really exciting and fun kind of edited project, group project, where we're looking at the kind of the, you know, mostly sort of identity through the lens of cuisine over a long period of time, over a large region with, you know, integrating different people's papers. So as far as my own work goes, though, I became fascinated with the American Protestants that we were talking about earlier in the program, who were involved in the interwar abstinence movement and involved in the abstinence movements prior to that. And so I've done a lot of reading on them and on their kind of larger role in Bulgarian history over this period, what kinds of impacts they had, what kinds of things they were involved in. And so I haven't really, the book hasn't totally taken shape yet, but I think abstinence and looking more at alcohol as opposed to tobacco, which opens up a whole different kind of range of questions, looking at alcohol and religion, looking at sort of drinking culture in Bulgaria and how that, you know, you kind of take drinking culture and then this encounter with these very anti-drinking kind of elements that come in Protestants, how that kind of weaves its way into socialism and these kind of things. So this is, I think, probably where my next book is going. But I've also written on Protestants and hygiene, for example. I'm looking at Protestant reactions to violence on the ground in the Balkans. And so there's a lot of different kind of elements to that project. And so I haven't really decided exactly where to take it, but so we'll have to see.
Well, it all sounds very interesting, and I'm sure that we'll look forward to talking to you about your next book project once it finally takes shape and is given birth to and published. So thanks again for your time. And in the meantime, thanks to our listeners for joining us today, and we look forward to next month's conversation about a new book in East European Studies.